Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1101. Fascism, 2019 World Tour, Part 11. The Infirmarium Continuity, Part 2, subtitled The Pivot Point, Reflections on the Pivot Point. This is being recorded on November 19th of the year 2019. Now, what I'm going to do, since this is such a cumbersome topic, I'm going to plunge right back in for the last three programs we have been accessing. A very important yet very pedantic academic paper authored by Marlene Laruelle, L-A-R-U-E-L-L-E, and Ellen Rivera, Imagined Geographies of Central and Eastern Europe, the Concept of Infirmarium, from published in Covert Action magazine of March 23rd of 2019. Now, what I'm going to do as we get to the concept of the pivot point, a couple of programs, including the first program in this particular series, For the Record program number 1098. We had an article by Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald talking about Sir Harold Mackinder's view of Ukraine as the pivot point for control of the world or Earth Island or Eurasia. That is going to be key for our discussion, looking ahead, and we are jumping ahead, to the concept of to the things going on vis-a-vis the impeachment. What really has gotten Trump in trouble, whereas he has completely disregarded everything, he withheld or tried to withhold military aid to Ukraine in order to get information on Biden. And the thing that got him in trouble was not trying to get information on Biden. Trump could do just about anything. But when you try to withhold military aid to Ukraine, he is coming across not only deep politics and the so-called deep state, he is coming across a geopolitical gambit and a geopolitical concept that dominates the 20th and 21st centuries and embraces fascism. To give people a look ahead to the discussion of impeachment, I'm not going to spend that much time on it. But again, Trump could do anything. On stage in the Republican convention, he ogled his daughter Ivanka in an overtly sexual manner, then grabbed the upper part of her rear end on stage on the Republican convention. Nobody blinked. He could do just about anything, but there are things you don't do. And when he attempted to withhold military aid to Ukraine in exchange for dirt on Joe Biden, he crossed a line you don't cross. He crossed not only the deep state, but a geopolitical dynamic that dominates the 20th and so far the 21st century. From the New York Times of Friday, November 15th, the Western edition of 2019, by David Sanger, for President, Case of Policy versus Obsession. Skipping down. In an otherwise divided Washington, one of the few issues of bipartisan agreement for the past 6 years has been countering the Russian President Vladimir V. Putin's broad plan of disruption. That effort starts in Ukraine, where a hot war has been underway in the east for 5 years, and a cyber war underway in the capital, Kiev. It is exactly that policy that Mr. Trump appears to have been discarding when he made clear in the haunting words attributed to Gordon D. Sondland, S-O-N-D-L-A-N-D, who parlayed political donations into the ambassadorship of the European Union, that, quote, President Trump cares more about the investigation of Biden, unquote, than about Ukraine's confrontation with Mr. Putin's forces. Well, aside from all of the disinformation, there's been a lot of it vis-a-vis Russiagate. That article highlights what is really at stake in the impeachment. And the reason I have been going into this infirmarium concept, and we're going to talk about the pivot point, in the context of not only Ukrainian and world island politics, but global fascism. Ukraine, as we have seen, and the Azov Battalion in particular, has become a focal point of training and networking for Nazis and fascist groups around the world, both on an institutional level and individually, and they have been spreading out to the U.S., to Western Europe, and there is also the possibility of the powerful Russian fascist community ultimately coming to head of the government there should Putin falter. They want to get rid of Putin. They better be very careful. But it is the Ukrainian fascist milieu and its central role in the Intermarium concept and the overlapping Promethean League that we are focusing on here. And it is Ukraine's position as the pivot point that is fundamental to an understanding not only of why Trump is in trouble now, and also what is going on around the world with the Azov Battalion networking with fascists, probably sector networking with fascists, sending them to East, to Western Europe, all over the place. It is Ukraine's position as the pivot point and control for the Earth Island against the background of global fascism that we will be looking here. Now, again, excerpting this essay by Ms. Lacouel and Ms. Rivera, some key aspects. The continuity of institutional and individual trajectories from Second World War collaborationists to Cold War era anti-communist organizations to contemporary conservative U.S. think tanks is significant for the ideological underpinnings of today's Intermarium revival. And exemplifying this in some key aspects, key excerpts from that essay. And this is overlap with our last show. In 1967, the World Congress of Free Ukrainians was founded in New York City by supporters of Andrei Melnik, the head of the OUNM, which, like the OUND, was also allied with Nazi Germany. It was renamed the Ukrainian World Congress in 1993. In 2003, the Ukrainian World Congress was recognized by the UN Economic and Social Council as an NGO with special consultative status. It now appears as a sponsor of the Atlantic Council. The continuity of individual and institutional trajectories from Second World War collaborationists to Cold War era anti-communist organizations to contemporary conservative U.S. think tanks is significant for the ideological underpinnings of today's Intermarium revival. This goes all the way back to the immediate post-World War I period and Josef Pilsudski. The Promethean League, by the way, heavily overlapped with the Intermarium network. According to the British scholar and journalist Stephen Dorrell, D-O-R-R-I-L, the Promethean League served as an anti-communist umbrella organization for anti-Soviet exiles, displaced after the Ukrainian government of Simon Petliura gave up the fight against the Soviets in 1922. As Dorrell affirms, quote, the real leadership and latent power within the Promethean League emanated from the Simon Petliura-dominated Ukrainian Democratic Republic in exile and its Polish sponsors. The Poles benefited directly from this arrangement as Promethean military assets were absorbed into the Polish army with Ukrainian, Georgian, and Armenian contract officers not uncommon in the ranks. The alliance between Pilsudski and Petliura became very unpopular among many Western Ukrainians as it resulted in Polish domination of their lands. This opposition joined the insurgent Ukrainian military organization UVO in 1920, which later transformed into the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, or OUN. This is the immediate post-World War I period, and note the primary role of the Ukrainian fascists in these networks. Based on CIC agent William Gowan's reports, such authors as Christopher Simpson, Stephen Dorrell, Mark Ahrens, and John Loftus have suggested that the networks of the Promethean League and the Intermarium were utilized by German intelligence in World War II, and then jumping to U.S. intelligence. American intelligence began to take notice of the Intermarium network in August of 1946 in the framework of Operation Circle, a counterintelligence corps, or a CIC project, the original goal of which was to determine how networks inside the Vatican had spirited away so many Nazi war criminals and collaborators, mostly to South America. Among the group of CIC officers involved in the operation was Levy's source William Gowan. Then a young officer based in Rome, Gowan suspected the Intermarium Network to be behind Nazi war criminals and collaborators' extensive escape routes from Europe. The Intermarium and Promethean Networks jumped to American intelligence after they had been used by the Nazis. According to Ahrens and Loftus, although he had initially been thoroughly opposed to this course of action, by early 1947, Gowan was strongly advocating that American intelligence should take over Intermarium. Before long, the counterintelligence corps officer was no longer hunting for Nazis, but recruiting them. Then the Intermarium and Promethean networks flow into the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, originally the Committee of Subjugated Nations, formed in 1943 by Adolf Hitler. This became a key element of the World Anti-Communist League. A vast number of anti-communist organizations were formed in the immediate post-war period and supported by the U.S. They constitute one of the main components of the Intermarium genealogical tree in the sense that they revived the memory of Pilsudski's attempt to unify Central and Eastern Europe against Soviet Russia and gave them new life, but blended this memory with far-right tones inspired by collaboration with Nazi Germany. The most important of the European anti-communist organizations was the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, or ABN. Because fascist movements were, in the 1930s, the first to organize themselves against the Soviet Union, the ABN recruited massively among their ranks and served as an umbrella for many former collaborationist paramilitary organizations in exile, amongst them the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, Bandera, or OUNB, the Croatian Ustashi, the Romanian Iron Guard, and the Slovakian Linka Guard, that's H-L-I-N-K-A. It thus contributed to guaranteeing the survival of their legacies at least until the end of the Cold War. According to the Liberal Institute for Policy Studies think tank created by two former aides, the Kennedy advisors, the ABN was the, quote, largest and most important umbrella for former Nazi collaborators in the world. And note the role of the Croatian Ustashi, the Intermarium support group that is generated by the Azov Battalion, is networking with other groups, primarily the Croatian Ustashi, who have basically been rehabilitated in Croatia. The most active groups within the ABN became the Ukrainian and Croatian organizations, particularly the Ukrainian OUN. The OUN, under the leadership of Andrei Melnyk, M-E-L-N-Y-K, collaborated with the Nazi occupiers from the latter's invasion of Poland in September of 1939. The Gestapo-trained Mikola Lebed and the adherents of Melnyk's younger competitor, Stefan Bandera, in sabotage, guerrilla warfare, and assassinations. The OUN's 1941 split into the so-called OUNB following Bandera and OUNM following Andrei Melnyk did not keep both factions from continuing to collaborate with the Germans. And another important element in the Intermarium continuity is Theodor Oberlander, an Abwehr and SS officer and the political officer of the Nachtigall, or Nightingale, battalion, under Roman Shukevich that performed the Lvov pogrom and other atrocities during World War II. While in Soviet Ukraine, the UPA kept on fighting against Moscow until the early 1950s, their capacities were exhausted. As Federal Minister for Displaced Persons, Refugees, and the War Damage during the Adenauer government, Oberlander played a crucial role in the rise of the ABN and allowed the Ukrainian collaborationists to take the lead in it. Yaroslav Stetsko, who presided over the Ukrainian collaborationist government in Lviv from early June, from June 30th of 1941, led the ABN from its creation in 1946 until his death in 1986. And then, confirming the primacy of the ABN with, of the OUNB within the ABN.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
The Counterintelligence Corps, that's Army Counterintelligence, confirmed that by 1948, both the Intermarion and the UPA, Ukrainian Partisan Command, reported to the ABN president, Yaroslav Stetsko. The UPA, in turn, had consolidated all the anti-Soviet partisans under its umbrella. Yaroslav Stetsko was also secretary of OUNB and second-in-command to Bandera, who had the largest remaining partisan group behind Soviet lines under his direct command. Thus, OUNB had achieved a leadership role among the anti-communist exiles and was ascendant by 1950. We're going to talk about some of the intervening history and the deep politics later. Note what's happening with the Intermarium concept in contemporary Ukraine. The most recent reincarnation of the Intermarium has taken form in Ukraine, especially among the Ukrainian far right, which has reappropriated the concept by capitalizing on the solid ideological and personal continuity between the actors of the Ukrainian far right in the interwar and Cold War periods, and their heirs in Ukraine today. The role in perpetuating the Intermarium concept, Intermarium continuity, the widow of Yaroslav Stetsko, Yaroslava or Slava Stetsko, who basically took over where her husband left off. This continuity is exemplified by the wife of longtime ABN leader Yaroslav Stetsko, Yaroslava Stetsko, a prominent figure in the Ukrainian post-Second World War emigre community who became directly involved in post-Soviet Ukrainian politics. Having joined the OUN at the age of 18, she became an indispensable supporter of the ABN after the war. In July of 1991, she returned to Ukraine and in the following year formed the Congress of Ukrainian Nationalists, or CUN, a new political party established on the basis of the OUN and presiding over both. Although the CUN never achieved high election results, it cooperated with the Social National Party of Ukraine, or SNPU, which later changed its name to Svoboda, the far-right Ukrainian party that continues to exist. And then note that Slava Stetsko's husband, Yaroslav Stetsko's former secretary, Roman Svarich, is not only key to the formation of the CUN, but is deeply involved with the Azov Battalion. The co-founder of the CUN with Slava Stetsko and formerly Yaroslav Stetsko's private secretary, the U.S.-born Roman Zvarych, Z-V-A-R-Y-C-H, represents a younger generation of the Ukrainian emigre community active during the Cold War and a direct link from the ABN to the Azov Battalion. Zvarych participated in the activities of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations in the 1980s. In February of 2005, after Viktor Yushchenko's election, Zvarych was appointed Minister of Justice. According to Andrei Beletsky, the first commander of the Azov Battalion, a civil paramilitary unit created in the wake of the Euromaidan, Zvarych was head of the headquarters of the Azov Central Committee in 2015 and supported the Azov Battalion with volunteers and political advice through his Zvarych Foundation. And then institutionalizing the revisionist history of the OUN and UPA, both of which were active extensions of the Third Reich's political and national security establishments, and then survived in the Cold War period, this part of the Intermarium continuity. The reintroduction of the intermarium notion in Ukraine is closely connected to the broad rehabilitation of the OUN and the UPA, as well as of their main hero, Stefan Bandera, during his presidency of 2005 and 2010, and particularly through the creation of the Institute for National Remembrance. Viktor Yushchenko built the image of Bandera as a simple Ukrainian nationalist fighting for his country's independence. And then of his wife, that is to say, Yushchenko's wife, from the OUNB milieu in the U.S. It is not unlikely that Yushchenko's readiness during his presidency to open up to right-wing tendencies of the Ukrainian exile leads back to his wife, who had connections to the ABN. Katerina Shumachenko, born in 1961 in Chicago, was socialized there in the Ukrainian exile youth organization, SUM, in the spirit of the OUN. Via the lobby association Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, or UCCA, she obtained a post as special assistant in the U.S. State Department in 1986 and was, from 1988 to 1989, employed by the Office of Public Liaison in the White House. And then, after these elements were projected back into Ukraine following the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Free Congress Foundation's Liberation Branch was critical to that. We talked about that in AFA 36, AFA 37, and in For the Record Program 778. These elements came to the fore in Ukraine. This rehabilitation trend accelerated after the Euromaidan. In 2015, just before the 70th anniversary of Victory Day, Volodymyr Vyatrovich, Minister of Education and longtime director of the Institute for the Study of the Liberation Movement, an organization founded to promote the historic narrative of the OUN-UPA, called on the parliament to vote for a set of four laws that codified the new post-Maidan historiography. Two of them are particularly influential in the ongoing memory war with Russia. One, decrees that OUN and UPA members are to be considered, quote, fighters for Ukrainian independence in the 20th century, making public denial of this unlawful. In For the Record Program 1072, I read into the record, in both 1071 and 1072, I read into the record an article from The Nation magazine. That is linked, as is For the Record 1072. And the author of that article noted the effect of not only the illustration laws and the Institute for Historical Memory, or the Institute for the Study of the Liberation Movement, and their complete reversal of historical reality. Within several years, an entire generation, I would add, first in Ukraine, then perhaps later, will be indoctrinated to worship Holocaust perpetrators as national heroes. Indeed, that is what is going on in Ukraine today. Now, of the Intermarium support group and the Azov Battalion, bearing in mind Roman Zvorich's heritage from the OUNB, secretary to Yaroslav Stetsko, co-collaborator with Slava Stetsko, and a key person in the development of the Azov Battalion. In this context of rehabilitation of interwar heroes, tension with Russia, and dissolution with Europe over its perceived lack of support against Moscow, the geopolitical concept of Intermarium could only prosper. It has found its most active promoters on the far right of the political spectrum, among the leadership of the Azov Battalion, of the Intermarium Support Group. In 2016, Andrei Beletsky created the Intermarium Support Group, or ISG, introducing the concept to potential comrades in arms from the Baltic Black Sea region. The first day of the founding conference was reserved for lectures and discussions by senior representatives of various sympathetic organizations, the second to the, quote, leaders of youth branches of political parties and nationalist movements of the Baltic Black Sea area. It also included, quote, military attachés of diplomatic missions from the key countries in the region, Poland, Hungary, Romania, and Lithuania. And note not only the military connections of some of these participants, they also are obviously representatives of, quote, nationalist organizations, read fascist. Note also their emphasis on training youth brigades and also giving military training to those youth brigades. On October 13th, 2018, the ISG organized its third Congress. Besides the Ukrainian hosts, a large share of the foreign speakers from Poland, Lithuania, and Croatia had a paramilitary background, among them advisor to the Polish Defense Minister Jerzy Targalski and retired Brigadier General of the Croatian Armed Forces, Bruno Zorica. Among the talking points of Polish military educator Damian Duda were, quote, methods of the preparation of a military reserve in youth organizations, unquote, and the, quote, importance of paramilitary structures within the framework of the defense complex of a modern state. Something to keep in mind, that if the global economy collapses, and who knows what's going to happen with that, I would note the trade war with China, and it's certainly making things difficult. It's roiling markets. If that contributes, and we'll talk about the Earth Island and pan-Turkism and what's going on with China in future shows, that could help. If there is a global economic collapse, the deprivation that will be experienced by middle, lower middle, and working class people may very well drive people in Western Europe into the arms of fascist organizations. We might see at some point organizations like the Freedom Party in Austria coming to power again, the Sweden Democrats in Sweden, which are leading in polls, the National Front in France, the Alternative for Germany in Germany, and indeed the EU could become a fascist EU. Although the EU itself is a vehicle for German economic dominance, its social values, pro-immigrant, pro-gay rights, and anti-censorship are relatively liberal. That may change. Now, some of the deep politics behind the Infirmarium continuity and the dominant place in the evolution of the Infirmarium continuity from the immediate post-World War I period on up to the period between the wars, World War II, the Cold War, and then on up to the present. We're going to talk about some of the deep politics that developed with that. On the website, the SpitfireList.com website, there is a paper by the late Carl Oglesby from Covert Action Information Bulletin, as it was called, a Covert Action Quarterly, number 35, called The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt. And this is about the Reinhard-Gehlen organization and the deal it worked out with CIA. It became not only the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, but the de facto NATO intelligence organization, and ultimately the BND, the German Intelligence Service. About this, and about the relationship between the Gehlen organization on the one hand to the Third Reich, and also to CIA, and also to these elements, to the OUNB, the elements of the ABN that we have been talking about, Oglesby writes, Gehlen became chief of the Third Reich's Foreign Armies East, or FHO, on April 1st of 1942. He was thus responsible for Germany's military intelligence operations throughout Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. His FHO was connected in this role with a number of secret fascist organizations in the countries to Germany's east. These included Stefan Bandera's B faction of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, or OUNB, Romania's Iron Guard, the Ustashi of Yugoslavia, the Vanagis of Latvia, and after the summer of 1942, Vlasov's Army, the band of defectors from Soviet communism, marching behind former Red Hero General Andrei Vlasov.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Later on in the war, Galen placed one of his top men in control of foreign armies west, which broadened his power. And then after Admiral Wilhelm Canaris was purged and his Abwehr intelligence service cannibalized by the SS, Galen became, in effect, Nazi Germany's overall top intelligence chief. Now, we've spoken about this in the past, but note that when we're talking about the ABM, when we're talking about the OUNB, we are talking about organizations that not only were the heirs to the Intermarium continuity, again, stretching in the person of Ukraine, or in the milieu, love that word, of Ukrainian fascism from the immediate post-World War I period on up through the period between the wars, the Promethean League, the Intermarium, then jumping to Third Reich intelligence, and in so doing we see the fusion of the OUNB and these other organizations with the Galen spy outfit. That in turn jumps to CIA, later becomes de facto NATO intelligence, and ultimately the BND. As we spoke about in For the Record in AFA programs, actually I should say in AFA program number 1 and in For the Record program number 777, the UPA/OUNB guerrillas in Ukraine actually continued to conduct guerrilla warfare in Ukraine with groups that were originally formed under the command of the Third Reich and the Galen organization, and then basically had their stewardship assumed by CIA and Western Intel. Again, a continuity of the Intermarium milieu. Now, something to understand about the Galen organization, and again, from the essay by Carl Oglesby, Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt, bearing in mind that there was a continuity of combat from the World War, the guerrilla warfare combat from the World War II period on up into the early Cold War period in Ukraine, with the OUNB/UPA guerrillas basically, I would say, switching uniforms, but their godfathers, so to speak, switched from Galen to people like Frank Wisner and Alan Dulles. Now, noting that the Galen organization at the same time represents a perpetuation of the Third Reich's national security establishment into the Cold War period and through today. Returning to Oglesby's essay. Indeed, a partly declassified CIA document recapitulated this story in the early 1970s, noting at this time, quote, Galen met with Admiral Karl von Dönitz, who had been appointed by Hitler as his successor during the last days of the Third Reich. Galen and the Admiral were now in a U.S. Army VIP prison camp in Wiesbaden. Galen sought and received approval from von Dönitz, too. As Galen was about to leave for the U.S., he left a message for Gerhard Bonn with another of his top aides, Gerhard Wessel. Quote, I am to tell you from Galen that he has discussed with Hitler's successor, Admiral Karl Dönitz, and Galen's superior and chief of staff, General Franz Halder, the question of continuing his work with the Americans. Both were in agreement. as Oglesby notes. In other words, the German chain of command was still in effect, and it approved of what Galen was doing with the Americans. The whole concept of the deal he was about to offer his conquerors had been approved by a Nazi chain of command that was still functioning, despite what the world thought, and still does think, was the Nazis' unconditional surrender. And by the way, I would note in For the Record 761, we note that the BND continued to recruit from the descendants of SS and Gestapo members, and that those records were purged by Ernst Urlau, who became head of the BND. He had been police chief in the city of Hamburg when the Hamburg police had Mohammed Atta's cell under surveillance. He then became the chief advisor to Chancellor Helmut Kohl on intelligence matters in 1998, and then became head of the BND in 2005. And under his watch, those records of recruiting into BND from the families of former SS, or shouldn't use the word, former of SS and Gestapo veterans were purged. I will also note that Ernst Urlau's, CV is very unusual. He goes from being head of the Hamburg police to special advisor to the Chancellor of Germany on intelligence matters, and then head of the Federal Intelligence Service. Now, noting here, and again, I realize that much of this is by way of review, but this is to establish the real intermarium continuity within the power politics of the 20th century, international fascism, and the Earth Island. We have noted in the past the Crusade for Freedom. That was a binary intelligence operation, which on the one hand saw the CIA/OPC sponsorship of the Galen Organization and the ABN and the OUNB guerrillas, and at the same time there was a domestic element to the operation in which leaders from the OUNB, from the Iron Guard, the Croatian Ustashi, the Bulgarian National Front, the Hungarian Arrow Cross, etc., were incorporated into the Central and Eastern European population groups in cities in the so-called Rust Belt, the industrial Midwest, and Northeast, and they became a key element of the Republican Party. They were viewed as being able to get out the vote in five key states during the presidential elections. And this represents an element of continuity running all the way from the Führer bunker, then occupied by Admiral von Dönitz, up through the Galen spy organization when it jumps to CIA and OPC. And then, in turn, that same milieu is incorporated into the Republican Party as the Republican Heritage Outreach Council, literally a Nazi branch of the Republican Party. That is where the aforementioned Ekaterina Tymoshenko, later Ekaterina Yushchenko, comes to be the Deputy Director of Public Liaison for Ronald Reagan. That is how she figures into this. Then she becomes Mrs. Yushchenko and is fundamental to the rehabilitation of the OUNB and the UPA. Intelligent historical criticism or recitation of which at this point is criminal, if you say basically they were Nazi collaborators and war criminals, you can be prosecuted. Now, from The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, whose collaborator, by the way, was in part William Gowan, of the development of the Crusade for Freedom. Frustration over Truman's 1948 election victory over Dewey, which they blamed on the Jewish state, impelled Alan Dulles and his protege Richard Nixon to work toward the realization of the fascist freedom fighters' presence in the Republican Party's ethnic outreach organization. As a young congressman, Nixon had been Alan Dulles' confidant. They both blamed Governor Dewey's razor-thin loss to Truman in the 1948 presidential election on the Jewish vote. When he became Eisenhower's vice president in 1952, Nixon was determined to build his own ethnic base. Vice President Nixon's secret political war of Nazis against Jews in American politics was never investigated at the time. The foreign language speaking Croatians and other fascist emigre groups had a ready-made network for contacting and mobilizing the Eastern European ethnic bloc. There is a very high correlation between CIA domestic subsidies to fascist freedom fighters during the 1950s and the leadership of the Republican Party's ethnic campaign groups. The motive for the under-the-table financing was clear. Nixon used Nazis to offset the Jewish vote for Democrats. In 1952, Nixon had formed an ethnic division within the Republican National Committee. Displaced fascists, hoping to be returned to power by an Eisenhower-Nixon liberation policy, signed on with the committee. In 1953, when Republicans were in office, the immigration laws were changed to admit Nazis, even members of the SS. They flooded into the country. Nixon himself oversaw the new immigration program as vice president. He even received Eastern European fascists in the White House. The key overlap between the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, basically a Nazi branch of the Republican Party, the Crusade for Freedom, this binary covert operation with a foreign component under CIA and OPC, and a domestic component under the Crusade for Freedom, the key people in the Republican Party in the post-war period were all part of this. At Richard Nixon, of course, he was vice president under Eisenhower for two terms, then was elected to two terms as president, but was removed in the Watergate coup because he wasn't far right enough. You'll see some other familiar names. These are the key Republican luminaries, and they are the key luminaries within the CFF and the Nazi wing of the Republican Party, which in turn is linked directly to Galen and this whole ABN milieu. As a young movie actor in the early 1950s, Reagan was employed as the public spokesperson for the OPC front named the Crusade for Freedom, unquote. Reagan may not have known it, but 99% for the Crusade's funds came from clandestine accounts, which were then laundered through the Crusade to various organizations such as Radio Liberty, which employed Dulles's fascists. William Casey, who, by the way, was Reagan's campaign manager and then became head of the CIA. Bill Casey, he also was the head of the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, under Richard Nixon. Bill Casey, who later became CIA director under Ronald Reagan, also worked in Germany after World War II on Dulles' Nazi Freedom Fighters program. When he returned to New York, Casey's committee replaced the International Red Cross as the sponsor for Dulles' recruits. And ultimately, whereas this Nazi branch of the Republican Party had only coalesced during presidential election years, it then became a permanent branch of the Republican Party. Who did that? It was George H.W. Bush who fulfilled Nixon's promise to make the ethnic emigres a permanent part of Republican politics. In 1972, Nixon's State Department spokesman confirmed to his Australian counterpart that the ethnic groups were very useful to get out the vote in several key states. Bush's tenure as head of the Republican National Committee exactly coincided with Laszlo Pastor's 1972 drive to transform the Heritage Groups Council into the party's official ethnic arm. The groups Pastor chose as Bush's campaign allies were the emigre fascists whom Dulles had brought to the U.S.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
And again, in AFA 36, AFA 37, and For the Record 778, we took a look at how under the Free Congress Committee, these elements were projected. Now, we're going to look at some of the even deeper politics of this. Really, this could go back to the Bush family collaborating with the peace and interests and the Bank for Handel and Schafart and its ownership by the Union Banking Corporation and its financing of the early Nazi party by Fritz Thyssen. Note that William Donovan, a key Wall Street lawyer, actually met with Adolf Hitler, had lunch with him in 1923. It was in the immediate post-World War I period that the Habsburgs hooked up with U.S. intelligence. But one of the key things in understanding the deep politics and why Trump, he could have done anything, but when he withheld military aid to Ukraine, the pivot point from which fascism is going to be spreading around the world. It's already the Azov battalion and the Azov milieu, as well as Ukraine and general private sector, are already serving as training grounds for lone wolf terrorists and are networking with fascist groups around the world. When Putin goes down, ultimately he will give up the presidency. These elements might come to the powerful Russian fascist milieu, could come to the fore in Russia, and we'll have a Yaki-ite Europe with Merkel and company and the CDU out of power, the National Front. Ultimately, the Ukraine as the pivot point to the world island is central here. And when Trump withheld military aid to the pivot point, he crossed deep politics that goes back, well, really dominates most of the 20th century, the rise of fascism, World War II, and ultimately rising through the assassination of JFK, and a great many other things as well. When the quote communist, unquote, the Marxist Marine Lee Harvey Oswald returned from the former Soviet Union, he was obviously A, a spy, and B, a patsy. Who met him upon his return? Spas T. Rakin, the Secretary General of the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. In For the Record Program 1058, 59, and 1060, we revisited the concept of the Christian West from the description for AFA 37 that goes into this at great length. When it became clear that the armies of the Third Reich were going to be defeated, it opened secret negotiations with representatives from the Western Allies. Representatives on both sides belonged to the transatlantic financial and industrial fraternity that had actively supported fascism. The thrust of these negotiations was the establishment of the Christian West. Viewed by the Nazis as a vehicle for surviving military defeat, the Christian West involved a Hitlerless Reich joining with the U.S., Britain, France, and other European nations in a transatlantic, pan-European, anti-Soviet alliance. In fact, the Christian West became a reality only after the cessation of hostilities. The denazification of Germany was aborted, although a few of the more obvious and obnoxious elements of Nazism were removed. Nazis were returned to power at virtually every level and in almost every capacity in the Federal Republic of Germany. Talked about that in numerous programs. The book, The New Germany and the Old Nazis by T.H. Pettens, is available for download for free on the website. Now, the Christian West negotiations were underway during World War II, and For the Record 1009. We spoke about the OSS, Alan Dulles, and William Donovan negotiating with Prince Max Eugen von Hohenlohe, a Habsburg in-law, who was acting as a representative for Walter Schellenberg in charge of overseas intelligence for the SS. Schellenberg, by the way, became a key Galen aide. He also was a member of the board of directors of IT&T. Now, in the book, American Swastika, Charles Higham, went into more detail about the Christian West negotiations. That book, by the way, published in hardcover by Doubleday and Company, copyright 1985 by Charles Higham. And he talks about the Christian West negotiations, again, between Prince von Hohenlohe acting as a proxy for Walter Schellenberg of the SS and later a key Galen aide, and the negotiations initially begun by Alan Dulles were picked up by Donovan and the OSS in general, and they became the M negotiations, basically. So this, the M group, I don't know what that stands for offhand, is a continuation of the Christian West negotiations. Now, this is what Alan Dulles basically agreed to. He said that it would be unbearable for any decent European to think that the Jews might return someday and that there must be no toleration of a return of the Jewish power positions. He reiterated his desire for a greater European political federation, we see that with the EU, and foresaw the federal Germany that did, in fact, take place. Dulles made the curious assertion that the Americans were only continuing the war to get rid of the Jews, and that there were people in America who were intending to send the Jews to Africa. This was Hitler's dream, of course, that the Jews would go to Madagascar and stay there. Dulles now proceeded to supply Hohenlohe with dollops of secret intelligence, announcing that the U.S. Army would not land in Spain, but after conquering Tunisia, would advance from Africa toward the Palestine oil fields and cut off the German oil supplies. He said it was likely that the Allies would land in Sicily to cut off Rommel and control Italy from there, and thus secure the advance in the Balkans. Having given virtually the entire battle plan for Europe, top secret at the time, to one of Germany's agents, Alan Dulles proceeded to the almost unnecessary rumor that he had very good relations with the Vatican. In other meetings, Mr. Dulles is committing flat-out treason here, giving the Allied battle plan to the Axis in early 1943. In other meetings, Dulles, quote, predicted that the next world war would be between the USA and the Soviet Union, unquote. Dulles obtained a great deal of information relating to Germany and plans for its reconstruction after the war. He described a recent speech by Dr. Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi propaganda minister, quote, as a work of genius. I have rarely read a speech with such rational pleasure, unquote. In July, OSS Chief William Donovan and the OSS began to take matters into their own hands. No doubt inspired by the invigorating meeting in Switzerland between Dulles and von Hohenlohe, Donovan embarked on the so-called M Project. By now, the German Franz von Papen had read the details of the peace proposal on microfilm and learned that it was more or less on the same lines as the Dulles proposals. Germany would be set up as the dominating force in industry and agriculture in continental Europe, at the heart of a continental state run by Germany, the USA, and Britain as a focus of trade. Of course, Alan Dulles became head of the CIA under Eisenhower. His brother and Sullivan and Cromwell and Nazi collaborator John Foster Dulles became Secretary of State. At the same time, the incorporation of the Japanese Golden Lily loot and the Nazi black gold into what was known as the Black Eagle Trust was formalized. This not only ensured the continuity of Japanese looting, but also the joining of the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization to the West. And we're going to conclude with this to understand the deep politics underlying the Intermarium continuity. From Gold Warriors, America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave, we read, the treasure, gold, platinum, and barrels of loose gems, was combined with Axis loot recovered in Europe to create a worldwide covert political action fund to fight communism. This Black gold gave the Truman administration access to virtually limitless unvouchered funds for covert operations. It also provided an asset base that was used by Washington to reinforce the treasuries of its allies, to bribe political leaders, and to manipulate elections in foreign countries. During the war, Secretary of War Henry Stimson had a brain trust thinking hard about Axis plunder and how it should be handled when peace came. Stimson's special assistants on this topic were his deputies John J. McCoy, like Alan Dulles, a Warren Commission member, and Robert Levette, L-O-V-E-T-T, and consultant Robert B. Anderson, all clever men with outstanding careers in public service and banking. McCoy later became head of the World Bank, Levette, Secretary of Defense, Anderson, Secretary of the Treasury, by the way, Levette and Anderson, under Eisenhower, along with John Foster Dulles in State, and Alan Dulles as head of CIA. More about the Black Eagle Trust. Their solution was to set up what is informally called the Black Eagle Trust. The idea was first discussed with America's allies in secret during July of 1944, when 44 nations met at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, to plan the post-war world economy, both with the recitation of the plans for the Black Eagle Trust, again, at the Bretton Woods Conference, and with the early 43 negotiations between Alan Dulles and von Hohenlohe representing Schellenberg, we see the formation for the post-World War II world and the Cold War. And it is these deep politics, this tremendous and stunning manifestation of fascism and global corporatism that basically Trump is cutting across. And that's why when we read in the New York Times, Friday, November 15th, in an otherwise divided Washington, one of the few issues of bipartisan agreement for the past 6 years has been countering the Russian President Vladimir V. Putin's broad plan of disruption. That effort starts in Ukraine, where a hot war has been underway in the East for 5 years, and a cyber war underway in the capital, Kiev. It is exactly that policy that Mr. Trump appears to have been discarding when he made clear in the haunting words attributed to Gordon B. Sondland, who parlayed political donations into the ambassadorship to the European Union, the quote, President Trump cares more about the investigation of Biden, unquote, than about Ukraine's confrontation with Mr. Putin's forces. That is why Trump is facing impeachment. That he's coming across the intermarium continuity. This concludes For the Record program number 1101, Fascism 2019 World Tour Part 11, The Intermarium Continuity Part 2, Reflections on the Pivot Point. This is being recorded on November 19th of 2019. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.